Welcome to Trending Health, where we provide leaders with valuable insights and perspectives on the evolving health industry. Brought to you by Vynamic, Trending Health explores topics that are real, relevant, and worth discussing. I'm your host, Jen Burke. In today's Trending News Europe episode, we're going to discuss a few recent newsworthy items we think healthcare leaders should be considering. I'm here with Vynamic's Jack Young and Ali May to talk about what's trending now. Ali, what headlines have you been following lately?
This is no-shows for medical appointments in France and how they could face a tax in the future. So every year in France, there are 27 million medical appointments that are missed. And a €5 no-show fee has been announced as part of a series of measures that are intended to boost the health service. So similar to many European countries that we've covered on this podcast, in France, they are experiencing staff shortages, increased costs, and growing demand with the aging population. So the French Prime Minister has said that patients would be required to give credit card details when they make the medical appointment, and the doctor can then charge them €5 if they do not turn up their appointment without giving notice 24 hours early. And according to Gabriel Attal, such a proposal would free up to 20 million appointments a year.
It's interesting to see this trending again, and I know that similar fines already exist in both Switzerland and Germany. And close to home here in the UK, I remember that the Prime Minister Rishi Sunak proposed a similar measure last year. I remember it going down very, very badly for the UK at least. And no-shows are, of course, a huge problem in the UK, given that over 1 million people do not show up to their GP appointments every month. And we've got a growing waiting list, which I think is around 7.5 million at present. That all being said, I'm not really too convinced that imposing fines is really the path forward, given that there are extenuating circumstances that can exist that have to be factored in. This could include things like not receiving your appointment letter. We know how the administrative processes of the NHS are pretty poor, as well as perhaps public transport challenges, as again, in the UK, we very much struggle with that regard due to things like strikes, as an example. And when you think about it, I'm sure there's also a cost associated with building in new mechanisms and processes for chasing these payments down. And that would, of course, increase workloads on office management staff.
It really is a complex issue. And the risk of unintended consequences, I think, is quite high here. There are so many reasons why a patient might not be able to attend their appointments. And we already know that patients living in more deprived areas, or patients with mental health conditions, or from minority ethnic backgrounds, are more likely not to attend their booked NHS appointments. And fines could put these patients off from even booking an appointment in the first place, which really does run the risk of their health and well-being deteriorating further. If you think about it from the patient experience perspective, if they have to put in their credit card details just to book an NHS appointment, it's just another barrier to them. And again, on the unintended consequences, how does that change the relationship between the patient and the doctor? Does the doctor now almost come across as a debt collector or other staff in the surgery, which could impact that level of relationship and trust?
Yeah, the more we talk about this particular issue, the more and more confident I feel that fines are actually not the way forward, particularly at a time where we're seeing continued staff shortages, which create significant challenges and postponements to care. And picking up on one of the points you mentioned earlier related to minority groups, to give an example, continuity of care for gender identity services in the UK is facing really significant challenges, with executives from London's Tavistock and Portman Trust recently voicing worry about the cancellation of appointments and poor communication with new services. So with all of that in mind, to layer on fines on top of that is going to be really counterproductive, in my opinion.
And we are seeing innovative solutions beyond fining to address this issue, which clearly exists of people missing appointments. We're seeing artificial intelligence being used to reduce the number of appointments that are being missed. So in Rotterdam, they've recently started using a predictive model to prevent appointment cancellations. And this artificial intelligence model checks who's most likely to miss an appointment based on 13 criteria, such as the distance they need to travel, whether they've no-showed before, the patient's age. And as a result, they then take action before the appointment and give them a phone call to reduce the risk of them being a no-show. And even in the UK, I mean, I know it's been implemented hospital by hospital and GP surgery by GP surgery, but receiving a text the day before reminding you you have your appointment at 10 a.m. tomorrow, I think has made a huge difference. So I think for France and the UK that and other nations that have considered the no-show tax, we will hopefully see a more inclusive approach, I think, and we can use technologies like AI, which might not have the unintended harmful consequences that a tax might do.
Yeah, I think no-show rates are certainly something we struggle with stateside as well. I was looking at an article that shows by specialty, it can range from 5% of a no-show rate, even up to 30% of a no-show rate. And our NIH really saw that some of these behavioral interventions can be quite effective when you're looking at the text reminders or the phone call reminders in lowering that. I think an early study showed it could drop even as far as from, you know, 20% down to almost 7% just through simple implementations like that. I know there's an investment, of course, for health systems to adopt that, but it can, you know, help defray some of that cost associated with no-shows without having to impose penalties, because oftentimes it might just be well-intentioned. I know myself, sometimes when I say, oh, I'll remember when my appointment is and don't write it down, that text reminder could be quite helpful. But other times things can change between when you schedule the appointment and when you're meant to go in. So maybe it's shortening that wait time in between, or even reducing the anxiety associated with canceling the appointment, making it really easy for patients to be able to not only be reminded if they need to, but opt out if they know that they can no longer make their appointment. When I was going through some of the data here stateside, one of the highest rates for no-show was actually in oncology, which was quite surprising. But Jack, I think you had a story from the oncology front that you wanted to share with us today.
Whether we like it or not, as we know, billions of microorganisms live on and in our bodies. These include things like bacteria, viruses, and yeasts. And these are collectively known as our microbiome. And these bacteria help us digest our food and help with our immune system in the fight against nasty pathogens. At the same time, we know that these gut bacteria in particular have been extensively studied in the context of cancer and in relation to how they might influence the effectiveness of cancer treatments, including immunotherapy and chemotherapy. And so to shed light on the diversity of the microbiome and how it might interact with cancer cells, researchers at the Netherlands Cancer Institute analyzed over 4,000 tumors in what was a landmark study to understand this relationship more clearly.
This is fascinating. And as you've just mentioned, I think the link between gut bacteria imbalances and colon cancer I have heard before. But I'm wondering if the researchers found links between bacteria and the effectiveness of other cancer treatments.
So they did discover a link between bacteria and therapy efficacy in patients with lung cancer. So patients with lung cancer with a particular type of bacteria called Fusobacterium in their metastases, for example, responded worse to immunotherapy than peers that didn't have this bacteria. And the results of this study actually correlate with an older study that was carried out at the Weizmann Institute of Science in Israel, which showed that some bacteria living inside human pancreatic cancers can actually protect tumors by inactivating a common chemotherapy drug. This study also showed that one class of bacteria known as gamma proteobacteria could break down gemcitabine, which is a drug used to treat a number of cancers, and this helped the tumors become resistant to the drug.
It's incredible to see that our microbiome can have such a marked impact on the effectiveness of cancer treatments. I think this shows the progress that we're making with understanding cancer and the treatments, really getting down to, okay, what bacteria in your body might impact your likelihood of you getting cancer, or how might the bacteria in your body impact the effectiveness of some of these treatments? Jack, I'm keen to know what you think this could actually mean in practice, and how might life sciences organizations need to rethink or reshape their approach to treatment for oncology in the future?
So I think, unlike the story that we shared in our February episode around molecular-based cancer treatment, I think we're a little bit too early in our understanding to see what practice changes may need to take place. And this is because many questions still remain regarding the relationship between tumors and the microbes that live in them. And it's still unclear as to whether these microbes play a role in the development of the tumor in the first place, or if they can be harnessed to help us in our fight against cancers. But what I can tell you is that in order for us to further our understanding of microbes and cancer, large pharma companies are making a significant number of deals and acquisitions in this space to expand their immuno-oncology portfolio. And so to give you an example, Boehringer Ingelheim acquired T3 Pharmaceuticals at the end of last year in a deal worth around $500 million. And that was to support a more comprehensive approach to cancer therapy development. And so in the years to come, targeting tumor microbes may be as important as going after the cancer cells themselves, leading to earlier diagnoses and even new treatments. However, that is still only just begun, so it'll be interesting to see how that develops in the coming months and years.
I have to say, Jack and Ali, I find this story so fascinating. I think in the broader health and wellness culture, at least here stateside, the microbiome is like very hot right now in terms of thinking about its impact on your overall health. We have so many probiotic or prebiotic products, and people are thinking about it as it incorporates into their overall wellness. I don't think, at least me personally, I've ever thought about the microbiome within even certain other subcell types in people's bodies, particularly for tumor types, and how that could impact our ability to effectively target and treat these tumors. We're increasingly getting more and more targeted in our therapies around oncology. And so this will just push that targeted therapy world, I think, even further along. And I'm excited to see what studies like this really uncover and how we're able to hopefully put it into practice to make therapies more effective for patients affected by cancer. While many of us are aware of the science and progress being made in treating cancers and in the oncology therapeutic area, unfortunately, there are so many more diseases that receive less attention, less funding, and may experience less innovation because they impact a smaller portion of the population. Holly, can you tell us a little bit about what we're seeing when it comes to rare disease in Europe at the moment?
A disease is considered rare when it affects fewer than 1 in 2,000 people. And this is a new report that has shown an estimated 36 million people are living with rare diseases across Europe, who collectively we're talking about 6,000 different rare diseases. A new action plan for rare diseases is now coming out from European member states, and with strong momentum coming through the individual national strategies as well. And this is to address current inequalities across European nations and provide a more comprehensive strategy.
It's good to see improvements in pan-European rare disease collaboration. I think it's a long time coming because people with rare diseases really do have the odds stacked against them. I am, however, interested to learn if there's a difference really between the average time to market for a rare disease product compared to a non-rare disease product. As from what I've seen, developing medicines that treat these particular type of diseases can be an expensive, complex, and also a risky process.
The data seems to show that there is a delay for rare diseases. However, it isn't necessarily in the development stage, but more in the time to availability post-authorization. So the average time to availability from marketing authorization to patient access for rare disease medicines is currently 625 days in Europe. And that is nearly 4 months slower than the average across all products.
A really large stark contrast there, Ollie, and it must leave so many patients with these devastating diseases without potentially life-changing or life-saving treatment. I know for the UK, for example, whilst we rejoined the EU Horizon scheme last year, that agreement does no longer include the European reference networks that were established to improve the care of patients with rare diseases, which I imagine is quite a large challenge.
That point around the UK's access to European reference networks, or ERNs, is really important. And the hundreds of millions of dollars of funding for both diagnostics and treatments that go through those networks has been a setback in our ability here to provide the best care for millions of children and adults with these rare conditions and complex diseases. And there are disparities within the European Union as well. So, for example, Germany It's often cited as a market leader and an example to follow when discussing access to treatment. In Germany, these rare disease treatments are deployed as soon as they're approved by the EMA. And then after a year, they then examine the evidence and decide on a commercial price. Whereas in other countries like Italy, they take a more rigorous approach and approval time can take over 400 days. And then even within a country such as Italy, they are facing their own challenges with access to medicines between regions. And it's not infrequent that one region approves a drug before another, which then leads to a postcode lottery type situation, depending on which region you live in, and a very understandable frustration in patients and relatives. Last year, I was working in the Spanish life sciences market, and each autonomous region in Spain has their own process for approving medicines. And there's a decentralized, localized approach there, which produces some similar frustrations to what we're seeing between regions in Italy as well. So this action plan for rare diseases is attempting to tackle this inequality, both between countries and then within regions or within autonomous states within European countries, through the pooling of resources and cooperation and coming up with, I guess, a unified approach.
Those many disparities in terms of access treatment across Europe for rare diseases, I'm really eager to track this story over time to see how improved collaboration between national regulatory medicine agencies, as well as regional authorities, amongst others, can hopefully help overcome this problem of those disparities in care and offer much needed hope for rare disease patients.
I think it's really great to see this action plan to improve the consistency of access to therapies for rare disease across the European market. I think it makes it a more attractive investment opportunity for life sciences organizations. We've seen a lot of life science organizations recently really start to double down in their rare disease portfolio as a core growth area. We saw the Alexion acquisition by AstraZeneca not too long ago. And I think it's a real win-win if we can sort of ease the glide path in such a major regional market to be able to bring these therapies that are under development to patients in a more equitable way. As always, Jack and Ali, we know the only constant in the healthcare industry is change. So I can't wait to hear what we're talking about next month. Thank you for tuning in to this episode of Trending Health. To help more listeners find the podcast, make sure to like, subscribe, or leave a review. For more information about this episode and the team behind it, check out trendinghealth.com. And to learn more about how Vynamic helps health companies transform by connecting strategy to action, visit vynamic.com.